And so, Daniel's going to close the workshop with a few happy thoughts. Daniel.
All right, thanks, Rob. So before I start, I just wanted to point out that, although of course I love Rob and he's wonderful, there was actually a large organizing committee, so I just want to quickly acknowledge everyone else. So Patrick Hayden, Alex Maloney, Matt Hedrick, Rob, Don Merolf, Mark Van Romstank, and Benny Yoshida-san. Thank everyone. Thank you. All right. So indeed, this is the last lecture. It's been a great workshop. I'm glad at least a lot of you are still here. Hopefully, this will be fun. And as with my other lectures, please ask lots of questions. So what we're going to talk about today is toy models of holography. Well, anytime that we look for a toy model, the first thing we need to do is decide which features of the thing that we're modeling are we trying to model. Because if we modeled all the features, it wouldn't be a toy model, right? We'd just be doing the real thing. And depending on which features we're interested in, we might have different kinds of models. For example, one toy model of holography, which we heard a lot about earlier this week, is the SYK model. This quantum mechanics of N Majorana fermions, which Douglas talked about in a nice lecture earlier this week, and then was also mentioned by Juan and Steve in the discussion. This is a model which is useful if you're interested in the kind of things that Steve just talked about, you know, these scrambling, chaos, out-of-time order correlation functions. But of course, it also throws out a lot, right? I mean, it's, ADS2, the gravity is kind of trivial. But, you know, that's not bad. It's good, right? Because that means that this is something you can really understand and where, the particular physics, you know, these out-of-time order correlators and so on, you can understand really very concretely. Another example, which we didn't hear much about, but if you'd been around the field the last few years, you might have heard a lot about, are these ON vector models. So these are free or almost free CFTs, usually in 2+1 dimensions, or there's analogs in 1+1 dimensions. Which are dual to gravity theories which have towers of higher spin fields in the bulk. Actually, the SYK probably has something like that in it too. And then these are used to model different features of the correspondence, you know, the large N expansion, renormalization group flows, and so on. The models I'm going to talk about today do not have either really the scrambling and chaos type things that you would study with SYK. Or some of the large N features, factorization and so on of these vector models, renormalization group flows and so on. And it's because I'm just going to pick different things that I want to illustrate, okay? And often when we talk about these things, people raise their hand and they say, oh, well, here's my favorite thing about holography and your model didn't include that. And, you know, I mean, of course that, you know, in any of these, anytime anyone gives a talk about any of these things, questions like that always come up. But that's just, they're toy models, right? We should think about what they do instead of what they don't do. I mean, of course, we should also think about what they don't do, but we shouldn't obsess over it. So let me now tell you a few things which I think are particularly interesting features of the ADS-CFT correspondence. Which I think are not particularly clear, say, in these models or in N equals 4 or the various other things that people have thought about. And then I'll give you some models which do illustrate them. And I should just say, some of this will sound familiar to people who were at my talk last week. I decided that's OK. It doesn't hurt to hear some things twice. And please ask more questions. So features of ADS-CFT. Perhaps, the most mysterious feature of ADS-CFT at least initially, is what I'll call radial commutativity. Here's ADS. We could have some, say we have some operator, phi of x, in the center of the bulk. You learned from Xi's lectures on reconstruction that you can represent this operator in the boundary theory via some sort of integral. There are higher order corrections in the interactions, which you know how to compute. So this operator in the bulk is an operator in the CFT. If this operator is near the boundary, then we basically know where it is in the CFT, right? So, because remember, yesterday we discussed we have this extrapolate dictionary for ADS CFT that says that if we take a bulk field, let's call it R and little x, R and big X, to the boundary, then we get a local CFT operator. So bulk operators that are near the boundary are just local CFT operators. Those aren't too mysterious. But this one in the center is kind of mysterious, right? Because there's this extra radial direction. Where did that come from? So, you know, where did the radial direction come from? Why is it that it's ADS D plus 1 CFTD? That sounds crazy. We can sharpen the craziness of that by looking at the algebra of these operators. So let me look at this disk now from the top. So here's phi of x. We could pick some local operator in the CFT on the same time slice. So let's put it over here, phi O of big X. You see these guys are space-like separated in the bulk. So you might think that the commutator of phi of little x and O of big X should be zero. Certainly if we were doing quantum field theory in the bulk, that would be true. Right? So in quantum field theory, the way that causality is enforced is by commutativity of local operators at space-like separation. And since quantum field theory is a pretty good description of the world that we see around us, even if there's a little bit of gravity, it better be true in at least some sense, right? I mean, otherwise we would know, you know, because we're not really living in quantum field theory. We're living in quantum gravity. But nonetheless, we measure commutativity at space-like separation all the time, right? You know, at the LHC, you know, in doing atomic physics, everything we do, we're measuring commutativity at space-like separation. Can this really be true, right? Can it really be that this operator in the CFT can commute with these local operators at the boundary that it's space-like separated from? Well, the answer is that no, it actually can't. So in quantum field theory, there's something called the time slice axiom. It's a formal property of quantum field theories, which we expect them all to obey. It says in any QFT, the algebra of local operators at a fixed time acts irreducibly on the Hilbert space. Okay. So if you've played with quantum field theories at all, this is a very plausible property to have. It's essentially saying that if you look at a fixed time, all the degrees of freedom are made out of phi, out of local operators. So certainly that's true in these free theories that we've been discussing in earlier lectures. It's also true, for example, in a spin chain. So say you have n qubits. Then any operator whatsoever on the Hilbert space of n qubits can be expanded into sums of products of Pauli operators acting on the individual qubits, right? So the local Pauli operators generate the entire algebra of operators. So that's this time slice axiom. But this has an immediate consequence, which is that anything that commutes with all O of X is trivial, right? So that's Schur's lemma, right? You have an algebra that's acting irreducibly on a Hilbert space, and then if you have an operator which you think commutes with all of the generators of the algebra, then that thing actually is trivial, meaning it's proportional to the identity operator. So if we really wanted this equation to be true in ADS-CFT, we would need this phi to be proportional to the identity operator. But it better not be, right? That would be a very boring kind of holography if everything in the bulk was just proportional to the identity operator. And actually, this is a proof that a quantum field theory in d plus one dimensions can't be equal to a quantum field theory in d dimensions, which I guess is something that probably you thought was obvious, but this is really a proof of that. Yes? Yeah. No. So that was if you restrict to a subalgebra. A subalgebra can have a center, but the entire algebra doesn't. Yeah. There we were looking in the subalgebra in a region, right? And that was able to have a center. But here we're looking at all the local operators. Yeah.
Yeah, good.
So I have to formalize this a little bit. So the rigorous formulation is you have a Cauchy surface and you have an open neighborhood of the Cauchy surface and you consider all the operators which are smeared against test functions with compact support in the neighborhood.
Anyway, so the question was, is that fine point irrelevant for this?
Yeah, it's irrelevant because the real statement of the rigorous statement of the axiom is that you say you have this neighborhood of a Cauchy surface. And then you consider all of the smeared operators with compact support in that neighborhood. And then the real statement of the time slice axiom is that any bounded operator that commutes with all of them is proportional to the identity. So that's this statement here. So it's true that in actual quantum field theories, you can't have operators that commute with everything. There's some topological, if the space is topologically non-trivial, it's not quite true because you can have topological field theories with no local operators, but that's not what we're discussing. Yes? Good. So I'm applying the axiom in the boundary theory. So phi of x is not a local operator. So bulk fields that are near the boundary are local operators. This is just some operator. I mean, this is clearly not local, right? I mean, this region has support also in time. So at a fixed time, this is a very complicated operator. But anything applies to non-local operators too, right? So I'm applying this in the CFT, and I'm saying even if you want this to be non-local, you can't have a non-local operator that commutes with all the local operators without being trivial. Probably in some sense it's reassuring that quantum field theory in d plus one dimensions can't be equal to quantum field theory in d dimensions. Then how do we make sense of the fact that quantum field theory gives a pretty good description of what's going on in the bulk, right? And somehow this holography is going to have to work despite that. We'll see that the loophole here is that we're not doing quantum field theory in the bulk, we're doing quantum gravity, okay? And the gravity is essential for this to possibly be true. And by the end of the lecture, hopefully that'll be obvious to you if it isn't already. So that's feature number one of the correspondence that I at least found kind of mysterious from the point of view of the CFT. And these other sort of types of models didn't make me feel better about it. All right, so puzzling feature number two is subregion duality. So these one, two, and three are the same as from my lecture last week, but we'll now say more about them. So in his lectures earlier this week, she also explained something else. He explained that sometimes these bulk operators can be represented not just as non-local operators over the whole boundary like this, but even over just in a, with support only in a sub-region of the boundary. Is there a question? Oh yeah. So say you thought that you had a quantum field theory. You know, so say you thought the quantum field theory here on the boundary of some region was equal to some quantum field theory in the bulk. Okay. I'm putting an assumption here though, which is that if I take a local operator in the bulk here and I move it to the boundary, I get a local operator. So I am imposing that. I mean, otherwise everything is isomorphic, right? So I mean, we gotta have some sort of, you know, the harmonic oscillator is isomorphic to the standard model and so on, right? So I mean, we have to. Right. No, they don't. No, but we're not talking about the Hamiltonian though. We're talking about the Hilbert space and the algebra of operators.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I didn't mention the dynamics in this argument at all. Okay. Yeah, and just to be clear, so then here hopefully it's obvious, right? Because you would need an operator over here that commutes, you know, with all of these, right? But you can't have one here. Okay. Good. So in subregion duality, so as she explained, if you take a boundary subregion A, so here I'm drawing ADS3, so a spatial subregion of the boundary is just an interval. Then there's this thing you can define, which is called the causal wedge of A, which is this kind of wedge of cheese here. So the precise definition of this causal wedge, is that, it's an intersection of some sets. So let me write it and then just quickly say what the sets are. Okay. So the idea here is that D of A is the boundary domain of dependence of A. So it's the causal diamond of A on the boundary. So that's this, you see this kind of diamond here that goes around, right? Like we could unwrap the boundary and here's A, and then its domain of dependence would be like that. And then J plus of D of A is the future of that diamond in the bulk, right? So it's kind of something like this. And then J minus of the diamond is the past of that thing in the bulk like this. So then their intersection will be this kind of wedge, okay? It's called the causal wedge. And then what she explained in his lecture is that, if I have an operator, phi of x in the bulk, and x happens to be in this causal wedge, okay, then it has a representation in the boundary. Where I do an integral which is just over d of a, dx, and then, you know, another one of these kernels, let's call it a, k sub a, o of x, right? So this bulk operator sitting here can be represented just as an operator in the CFT whose support is entirely within this diamond, right? So we can draw that from above just to get a little more intuition. So say here's our A, and then the causal wedge picks out some region like that. And then so now if I have a point X here, then there exists an operator, phi A of X, but there does not exist an operator, phi A bar of X. Okay, so this can't be represented on the complement of A. And actually, that's an example of the no-cloning theorem at work. So if you can represent it on this side, you're not going to be able to represent it on that side. This is actually, so point number two is actually closely related to point number one. Because here's our phi of x. Here's your favorite local operator. Over here, and we want to try. We want to understand whether or not this can commute with that. Right, that's radial commutativity. But we can just take A to be this, And then phi of x is clearly in the causal wedge of A. So I can represent it in the conformal field theory just as an operator with support here. And now in the conformal field theory, space-like commutativity is true. I mean, it's really true. You know, if we know anything about the conformal field theory, it's a quantum, we know it's a quantum field theory, so it has commutativity at space-like separation. And that means that we really do have that phi A of x, commutator O of x, equals 0. And then if you wanted, you could pick a different operator. You know, you could say, oh no, actually my favorite local operator is over here. And I'd say, oh, well, that's okay. I'll just, now I'll make A like this. And so then maybe we'll call this A prime. And then now this implies that phi A prime of x commutated, well, let's call this O prime to distinguish it, O prime of x is 0. So whichever local operator you pick in the boundary, I can come up with a representation of phi that actually commutes with it. A commutator is 0. Well, there's some slight subtleties with up to gravitational corrections and so on, but I'm not going to discuss them. So how can this be consistent with the time slice axiom, right? Because now it seems like, well, at least if all the different phi A and phi A prime and phi A prime prime and so on are all equal to each other, then we'll have constructed an operator that commutes with all the local operators in the boundary, and then we'll be back to being in trouble with the time slice axiom. So it must be that A and A prime are not equal to each other. And so we'll try to understand now in the future, later in the talk, you know, to what extent they are or aren't equal to each other. Now, one more thing about this subregion duality. So this is my favorite example. So now say we split the boundary into three regions, A, B, and C. So then A, B, and C each have their various causal wedges like that. Can have an operator in the center here, phi of x. And then now the funny thing is that, well, this guy is not in the causal wedge for either A, B, or C. So we don't have phi A, phi B, or phi C. But the thing is we do have phi AB, phi BC, or phi AC. So any two of the regions is enough to reconstruct the operator, right? This phi has a representation on any two of the region. So where's the information anyway, right? I mean, it's not on any one of them, but it's on any two of them. So this is a kind of surprising feature of subregion duality. I mean, to be clear, this can all be derived in the bulk by doing the kind of machinery that she was discussing where you derive these formulas. So it's apparently a true property of the ADS-CFT correspondence, as is this one. We just somehow have to understand how to harmonize that with the idea that really this is all going on in the CFT. All right, and then there's one more feature, which we talked about a lot about last week, so I won't say too much about this week, but I want to at least say something about it. A third surprising feature of the correspondence. This is the Ru Takenagi formula. The Ru Takenagi formula says that if we're given a boundary region A and a bar, and we draw this minimal surface here, gamma A, then the region to the left of here we'll call the entanglement wedge of A, and the region to the right we'll call the entanglement wedge of A bar. Then it says that S of rho A equals a trace of rho times some operator L plus some entropy rho EA. So this says that for a good states rho, and you know, now it should bother you a little bit what good means. But let's just say for good states for now. Rho, states in the CFT, if you compute their entropy on this subregion A, then it's equal to the expectation value of this operator, which so the operator is area of gamma A over 4G, and then there are corrections. So it's equal to the area of the extremal surface over 4G, then plus this thing, which is the bulk entropy of degrees of freedom in this entanglement wedge. So this is a little bit funny. I mean, what are the good states, for example? Originally this term wasn't there, and then there was some confusion about this is linear in rho, and this is not linear in rho, so how can it be true? So I talked at length about that last week. So here I'll just mention it, and then we'll see a little bit later in the talk how we are actually able to get this out of the models. Before going to the model, I just want to make one other comment. So I now mentioned two different wedges, right? So here I talked about this entanglement wedge, and here I talked about this causal wedge. And it's a natural question, are these the same thing? Are they not the same thing? How are they related? So they're definitely not the same thing. So just a simple way to see that they're not the same, and this is a good... Oh, yeah, question? Yeah?
So I've asked some people about this, but I'm still confused. Where's the minimization, I guess, in this way of writing, like the Ryotaki-Hanti formula?
It's in the definition of the operator here.
Okay, so that's like main area.
Yeah. So for example, you could define this by, you find the surface where the trace of the extrinsic curvature is zero, and that'll be a surface of extremal area. The minimization is not very clear from the general point of view I presented last week, but since I'm not going to talk about that today, I don't have to reply to it. Let me just quickly comment on the relationship between this causal and entanglement wedge. So let me actually give a slightly more honest definition of this entanglement wedge. So say gamma A is an extremal area surface, which is codimension 2 in the bulk, and that it's homologous to A. Okay. So what does homologous mean? Homologous means that there exists a codimension 1 surface, which I'll call capital C, which is space-like. Such that the boundary of C equals A union gamma A. So here, this slice here is like a C, right? So if we draw it, if we draw the covariant version, so here's A and here's A bar, here's this gamma A, so that's codimension 2, and then we have this surface here, which is chi, okay? And then finally, the entanglement wedge, EA, is defined as the bulk domain of dependence of this xi. So again, it kind of looks something like this, all right? So it looks a lot like the causal wedge, but in general, they're not equal. I'll give you the example where they're not equal in a sec, but let me first comment that in general, it's been proven that the causal wedge at least is can't be bigger than the entanglement wedge. So although I presented this subregion duality as holding in the causal wedge, that's the place where we know how to write down these kinds of formulas, you might wonder if it's true in the entanglement wedge as well. So let me just give one quick example of that. This is the sort of canonical example that everyone talks about. So consider A to be the union of these two rather long intervals, okay? So then the causal wedge, which I'll shade in orange, lies here and here. Okay? Because we can just apply this construction to each of the intervals separately. Taking them together doesn't buy us anything. But the Rutaki-Nagi surface, gamma A, is actually here. It's the union of these two green things. Because these guys are shorter than these white guys, okay? And, oh, I should have said, if there's more than one extremal area surface, you take the one of minimal area, right? So here, this green one is the one of minimal area, or length here, since we're in 2+1 dimensions. So then chi actually also includes this whole green region here. So chi is the union of the orange and the green. And so then there are points here which are in the entanglement wedge, but not in the causal wedge. And so then you might ask, could this sub-region duality be true in this larger entanglement wedge? Or is it really just true in the causal wedge, like these calculations that she was explaining would suggest? All right. And you know, until recently, that was a question to which we didn't know the answer, although a lot of people like the entanglement wedge. I mean, it's not crazy that you can go further than the causal wedge, because at least the entropy, which is the length of these things, you know from this formula. So at least there's one thing that's outside of the causal wedge, which you know. You know the area of the extremal surface. So if you can know one thing outside of the causal wedge, why not know the rest? Why not know everything in this green region? Why can't all that be represented in the CFT as operators on A? Okay, so these are the features of ADS CFT, which you know, the last few years I've been quite curious about. I think a lot of people have been wondering about them, and so the rest of the lecture we're going to try and present some. Well, I'll present some models which have all of these features, but in a sort of exactly soluble setting, where you can really see how everything works. So, any questions about the motivation? Before we go on to the models. All right, so the first model I'll discuss, I also discussed last week. It's the 3-qutrit code. So sorry for people who already listened to this, but you know, it can never hurt to hear something again, I guess. So, all right, first model, 3-qutrit code. So the basic idea is that you start by thinking about a totally different problem, which is that I have some state of a qutrit. So, you know, a qutrit is a 3-state qubit, runs from 0 to 2. And I want to send you this state. I want this state to, you know, I have it here in Waterloo, and I don't know, I want to send it to my mom in Baltimore or something. I want to do that. I want to do it in some sort of redundant way because, you know, international shipping is not so great, and, well, the U.S. Postal Service is even worse. We're at a classical trit. I could easily do that by just sending her the trit 100 times. Even if some of them get screwed up, that's okay. She can just do majority vote. But as Daniel Gottesman explained in his lecture, in quantum mechanics, that code, which is called repetition code, doesn't work because there's no cloning. So I can't clone the message 100 times and send it. I need to do something better. So the thing which is better I'm still going to use more degrees of freedom, so I'm going to send 3 qutrits instead of 1. I'm going to pick out a subspace of the qutrits, and I'm going to send the state on that subspace. So then this special subspace is spanned by these states, which we saw last week. Look like this. So there's a GHZ state. They're all kind of GHZ states, but they differ by various permutations and bit flips and so on. Okay. So that's the subspace we're going to use. Now, this subspace has several nice features. It's symmetric amongst the Q-trits. And all the states are very entangled. Okay. Now, the key thing, though, is that there exists, for example, a unitary transformation, U12, which has support only on the first two of the Q-trits. So maybe to make this a little more precise, we should say that this sort of encoded subspace we can refer to as the logical Q-trit. And then these three actual Q-trits we can call the physical Q-trits. Okay. So this is an operator with support on two of the three physical Q-trits. And the point is, we can find a U12, which has this nice property that if we act with U12 dagger on any of these basis states, then we get back just I on the first Q-trit times some state chi on the second two, where this chi is maximally mixed. And the reason that's nice is because now say that I send my mom the three Q-trits, but the third one gets lost, so somehow she only gets the first two. That's okay. She can just go down, to the family room and take her quantum computer and act on the first two Q-trits with U12 dagger. And then after she does that, hey, look, there's the state on the first Q-trit. And then there's this chi on the second two. Now, she doesn't have the third one. That was lost in the mail. That's OK. So she has a maximally mixed state on the second one, which she did get. And then she's got the state on the first one. And then the nice thing is that because of the symmetry of these, right, this is symmetric between the three physical Q-trits, it means that there's also going to be a similar U13 and a U23. So actually, whichever of the two Q-trits my mom gets, she'll be able to recover the state. So that's the magic of quantum error correction. Now, that should sound kind of familiar, right? Because we previously had this thing where we had the A, B, and C. And we had this operator in the middle of the bulk, and we could reconstruct it on any two of the boundary regions. So that should sound kind of like this. Just we're all paying attention. We can make it sound more like this by instead of talking about recovering the state, talking about operators. So say O is an operator acting on just one Q-trit. A single Q-trit operator. So it'll have some matrix elements, which I can write like that. Now, say that I want to implement this operator with these matrix elements on the code subspace. So this is called the code subspace. That's easy. I can just promote it to an O tilde. Which acts with these same matrix elements, but now it acts on the logical Q-trit. So this is a logical operation on the code, arbitrary logical operation. In general, this O tilde will be complicated. It'll have support on all three of the Q-trits. But in this particular case, I can do something clever. I can define an operator O12, where, first I act with U12 dagger to decode the message. Right, so now it looks like this. Then I just act with O on the first Q-trit with these matrix elements, and then I re-encode. So this is an operator which has support only on the first two physical Q-trits, right? Because U12 acts on the first two and O1 acts on the first one. So this has support only on two Q-trits, but it implements whatever logical operation we want. And moreover, there's also going to be an O13 and an O23. So I can implement this logical operation however I want on any two, using any two of the physical Q-trits. Now, let me say one more thing about the model. Then we'll discuss how it's like holography, although we also discussed this last week, but good to say it again. Maybe I shouldn't have just erased this, but I did. So, okay, the last comment is that now let's consider a general mixed state on the code subspace. So this is this row tilde will just be some admixture of outer products of these guys, arbitrary, you know, except that it has to be a state, so trace one positive Hermitian. Well, using this U12, we can write this as U12 row 1 tensor chi chi on 2,3 U12 dagger. So this row 1 here is an operator just on the first Q-trit, but that has the same matrix elements as this state would have on the logical Q-trits. Well, now why did I do that? Well, the reason is now we can compute the entropies. So let's first compute S of rho tilde 3. So rho tilde 3 is the partial trace over 1 and 2 of rho tilde. Okay, partial trace over the first two physical Q-trits. If you look at this state, so now the U12s are irrelevant, right? Because we traced over 1 and 2. So we're just left with this state, but then we traced also over 1 and 2. So then this is gone. And we're just left with half of this state chi. And chi is maximally mixed, so this is just log 3. Similarly, we can also compute S of rho tilde 1,2. So let's look at that. So now, since this is 1,2, we can again forget about the U12s, right? Because the entropy is invariant under unitary conjugation. So we can forget about those. Again, we just have this product state. But now there will be two terms. So we'll get the other half of this chi, right? So we'll get a log 3. But then we're also going to get the entropy of this. We get S of rho 1, OK? But actually, remember, rho 1 has the same matrix elements as rho tilde. And the entropy is just a function of the eigenvalues. So this is really just S of rho tilde. All right. All right, so now let's understand to what extent this model is holographic. So basic idea is that the physical Q-trits you should think of as being like local CFT degrees of freedom. Now this is a very simple CFT. It's a CFT with three lattice sites, right? Because there's three physical Q-trits. Each Q-trit has three states, so it's a quantum field theory with only three spatial points. But that's okay. We can still think of it as a quantum field theory. The logical Q-trit is going to correspond to a local bulk degrees of freedom. And since there's only one logical Q-trit, this bulk theory is going to be very simple. There's only one point in the bulk. So here's the theory. So we have our three boundary lattice sites, and then we have our one bulk lattice site. Now with this dictionary, I claim that we now immediately have properties 1, 2, and 3 that we discussed before. So let's remember, property one was radial commutativity. So let's look in the code subspace at the commutator of this any O tilde and say an operator that acts only on the third Q-trit. Right. So radial commutativity, it would have said that you know, an operator that acts just here should commute with operators acting there. So now with this dictionary, we see that an operator acting here is a logical operator. Like one of these O tildes that acts within the code subspace. And a local CFT operator is something that acts locally on one of the physical Q-trits at the boundary. So by symmetry, let's say it's the third one. But then we're cooking with gas because, this O tilde, remember, we can just replace it by O12 over there. And we saw that it acts in the same way on the code subspace. So this is 0. So we've arranged to have a non-trivial operator, right? This O tilde can act on the code subspace however we want, but it commutes with all the boundary local operators, at least within the code subspace. And that's going to be, of course, that's going to be the resolution, is that it's only within the code subspace. Okay, so that was radial commutativity. Subregion duality, we've also seen already, right? That was just this 012, 013, and 023. So we say that our bulk point is in the entanglement wedge of E12, of 1 and 2, 13, or 23, but it's not in the entanglement wedge of just any one of them separately. Right? So for example, here's the entanglement. So if this is 1, 2, 3, then this is the entanglement wedge of 1 and 2. This operator is there. Okay? So since it's an operator in the entanglement wedge, it should have a representation on 1 and 2, and hey, look, it does. So this model has subregion duality. So this is point 1, check. This is point 2, check. And the third thing we wanted was the Rutaki-Nagi formula. But hey, look, we got that too. Because if we define this area over 4G, just be log 3, then look. So if we look at row of 3, right, here's the minimal surface. There's nothing in the entanglement wedge, right, because this point is out here. So there's no bulk term. There's just an area term, and it's this log 3. And similarly, now if we look on this side, then now the entanglement wedge has a bulk point. The area, the minimal surface is still here, so we still get this log 3 from the area. But now here's the bulk entropy piece coming from whatever state we fed into there. So this model has kind of a lot, right? I mean, it has, has bulk effective field theory, has subregion duality, radial commutativity, Rutaki-Nagi. And actually, I claim it has black holes, too. Why does it have black holes? Well, I only told you about some of the states, right? So far we've been living life just in these three states. But that's not all the states. Hilbert space is 27-dimensional. We've only been talking about a three-dimensional subspace. I claim that the way that we should interpret the rest is that this point has been swallowed by a black hole in the rest of those states. And then which states they are correspond to the microstates of that black hole. So you see, that's where gravity is essential, right? Gravity gave us an excuse to only want these properties to hold in a subspace of the states. Because in the rest of the Hilbert space, this point could be eaten, right? And that's kind of the whole lesson of holography is, you've got some region, and you start cramming stuff in, and you're thinking, well, this region has some volume, and the volume is bigger than the area, so I got to be able to fit in more stuff than the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy. But right when you think you're going to succeed, right when you think you're going to beat the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy, cramming all this stuff in, then a black hole forms, and your stuff all gets eaten up by the black hole. You no longer necessarily need it to be described by effective field theory. So that's the loophole. That's how quantum gravity, that's how ADS D plus 1 is able to be equal to CFTD. All right, so that's all I wanted to say about this model. It's a fun model. We'll now try to describe some models which get a little bit closer to actually looking like the CFT. I mean, to some extent it's a little bit ridiculous, right? It's 27-dimensional Hilbert space, but still fun. Okay, yeah, question.
So this is a certain stabilizer code that has all these properties.
Yeah.
What set of codes have these properties? Perfect codes, or are there
No, certainly they don't need to be perfect codes. And certainly they also don't need to be stabilizer codes. So this one was a stabilizer code, and the next one I'm going to describe to you is also a stabilizer code, but that's just because I'm weak, right? I mean, the CFT is not a stabilizer code, and it still has all these properties. We do stabilizer codes because that's what we know, right? The lamppost.
But the state has to be absolutely maximally entangled.
No, that is not true. So the maximal entanglement is an artifact of this model, right? So in the CFT, nothing is ever maximally entangled, right? Because the Hilbert space is infinite dimensional. So you always want to, you never want to talk about things that are maximally entangled. They're always Boltzmann suppressions at high energies. So the general formalism I presented last week, just for anyone who remembers, I had this state chi, where the entropy was coming from. Well, here's a chi, right? So here I had this state chi, which is maximally mixed. In general, it doesn't have to be, but it's always the source of the area term. Yeah, actually, maybe I should emphasize that, right? So the area operator here was all coming from the entanglement in this chi, right? And this entanglement is important for the functioning of the code. Like, were this chi to be a product state? If you look at this equation, right, that if chi were a product state, it would mean that 3 just had no information about the state at all, right? If this were a product state, you could just throw out 3. You know, this U1,2 is irrelevant. And then it would never be the case that you could recover the information from 2 and 3 without being able to recover it just from 2. So the redundancy of the code, it's crucial this chi has entanglement. And that entanglement is precisely the thing that leads to the entropy here. And that's a general statement. So that's what I argued in my talk last week. But that's not what I'm going to emphasize this week. Or sorry, now. Okay. Yeah. Good. Yeah. So here the thing is, there's only one bulk point here. So once it gets eaten by a black hole, there's not really much left to say. So in general, you can once we start having more bulk points, you can consider code subspaces where some of them have been eaten and some of them haven't. And in that way, we can consider more and more generous code subspaces. Yeah. And then it's interesting to see how stuff gets passed around between the area and the bulk and so on as we do that. Yeah. So Debbie. Why isn't the black hole a subspace instead of a subsystem? Well, the thing is, because there are states where there isn't a black hole, right? Like in the vacuum, right? So if it were a subsystem, then it would always be there in some state, right? So, but we just think it's not true. Yeah. All right, yeah. Yeah, well, I guess it's kind of hard to tell what the dimension is. I mean, I guess if I were a mathematician, I would say both manifolds are zero-dimensional in this example. Yeah. So, right, that's part of why it helps to consider the more general things, where we can start seeing something of a continuum limit and get a better sense of what the dimensionality is. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah? Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Is there any analogy between, I mean, the terminals actually talk about the mass as you actually have a gap in error correction code?
Yeah, you mean like in surface codes or something, right?
I'm sorry?
You mean like in surface codes where you can write down some Hamiltonian where the ground state is the code subspace? Yeah. So, here it's going to have to be a little bit more sophisticated than that. Roughly speaking, the simplest code subspace to think about, indeed, is just the set of states in the CFT whose energy is less than some cutoff. And that's a fine way of coming up with a code subspace. The ones I'm going to think about are a little more general than that. So it's like you do that, and then you take the image of it under the conformal group to make it respect more of the symmetries of ADS. But I didn't write down a Hamiltonian for you here, and I'm not going to in the later ones either. That's one of the problems of this, which I guess Xiaoliang, if he's still here, mentioned at the end of the discussion yesterday. You know, that's still a thing that we're not very good at, writing down Hamiltonians. Okay, so let's proceed, right? So indeed, this is fun, but it's kind of, you know, maybe it's a little bit too trivial. So let's try and do something that's at least a little bit closer to actual ADS CFT. Okay, this is probably enough. So the next thing we're going to do is think about, instead of three qutrits, we're going to consider n qubits in a chain. So it'll be a spin chain. And you should think of this as a spin chain in a line. So it's not like one of Steve's spin chains where everybody is talking to everybody else with k-local interactions. Here we're talking about local, you know, one-dimensional spin chain. So now we're going to say we're going to have n qubits. And we're going to say those correspond to local CFT degrees of freedom. And then we're going to have a 2 to the k dimensional subspace, which is going to correspond to local bulk degrees of freedom. And we're going to define the subspace using tensor network. So, well, to define the subspace, clearly what I need to do is I just need to tell you the wave function of every state in the subspace. Okay? So now this J1 to JK tilde, that's like the analog, that was like my I tilde before. So this is the complete basis for the code subspace, the 2 to the K dimensional subspace. And this is the wave function of each such, you know, each state of, like that, in terms of the physical qubits, the n physical qubits. All right, so it's a very you know, concrete way of telling you what a subspace is. And, well, this is actually equal to just some, we can view this as being equal to some big tensor, I1 to IN, J1 to JK. And so this is a tensor with n plus k indices, and each index runs over 0 and 1. Right? So if I can give you a tensor like that, then I've given you a subspace. Now, that's not quite true, because I might want the different states to be orthogonal, in which case this tensor is going to need to have some special property. So roughly speaking, it's going to have to be an isometric tensor that you can view as an isometry from these legs into these legs. So then the idea is that we're going to build T out of smaller tensors, which I'll call P, I guess. So here's a simple example, right? So say that P is a tensor with three legs. I can take two of them, and I can contract one of the legs. And then leave the other two dangling. And this now gives me a tensor with four indices. Right? So that's the basic operation of tensor networks. We sort of view all the tensors hanging there in isolation, and then we sew together some of the legs to represent contracting the indices together. So this explicitly, I guess, would be something like sum over A, sum over D, P, A, B, C, or sum over C, P A B C, P A prime B prime C. All right, that's a four index tensor, A B, A prime B prime.
Dan?
Yeah?
I think you should say something about how that contraction on C is really defined. There's an implicit metric that's not the Hilbert space metric.
Here it's a delta, I guess, the way I wrote it. No, because it's the identity, right? So the identity is the same in any basis.
The identity is a 1-1 tensor, not a 2-0 tensor.
Yeah, but if the metric is flat, I don't have to. I mean, if I'm.
It makes no sense. There's a structure that you're assuming implicitly. I'm only pointing this out because I became very confused by this reading the papers.
Uh-huh. No, I don't think so, right? I mean, this is like when you're doing Euclidean, when you're working in just, you know, ordinary Euclidean space, when you write the dot product of a vector, right? I can write it like that, or like that, right? Or, you know, or like that, and we all know what we mean, right? Because we can raise and lower the indices for free.
That's because you have a metric on your real vector space. Here we have a Hilbert
Yeah.
Let's say, so, and it has a Hermitian inner product.
Yeah.
But here you need a non-Hermitian inner product.
Sorry, I mean, you're telling me that this...
It's not invariant under unitary transformations.
Oh, you mean if you want to hit a U here, you're saying you want me to put a U transpose instead of a U dagger?
Right, it would only be invariant that way.
No, it's invariant, right? Maybe what you don't like is the way I'm doing the map from Bras to Ketz, but I would say that this maps to I U dagger. Isn't that the?
No, I don't think that addresses the problem. But maybe if I'm not succeeding in.
Yeah, let's talk about it later, because I think if I just define it like this, it's correct. I think this is basis independent.
All right, we'll talk about it later.
Yeah. And even if it's not, for what I'm saying, we can just pick a basis. So, I mean, it's...
Yeah, I think that's what you're doing.
Yeah. I don't know if anyone else has any comments about that, but... The tensors P that I'm going to pick... So clearly, given a whole bunch of P's, I can sew them together in some way and try and make this T. I'm going to... To get something that looks like holography, I'm going to have to do something special. So the tensors that I'm going to take are what we call perfect tensors. So my P's are going to have the following form. So they'll have an even number of indices. So I1, I2, let's see, let's call it D or something. I don't have a good name. Okay, M. So there's some even number of indices, and moreover, any balanced bipartition of the indices into half and half, I want to be a unitary transformation. Okay, it's not obvious that there are tensors like that, right? So I claim that there are certain tensors, which we call perfect tensors, which have the property that any balanced bipartition of the indices gives you a unitary transformation. So there are, in fact, tensors like that. There aren't always, right? So if I tell you the number of indices and I tell you the range of the indices and I ask for a perfect tensor, one might not exist. But sometimes they exist. So one example of a perfect tensor is just this 3-qutrate code, which I just erased. So if I define ijk L tilde, for the 3-qutrate code, right? So this runs now from 0, 1, 2, and then each of these goes 0, 1, 2. Then this is actually a perfect tensor. You can basically, it's not too hard to derive that from the properties of these U's. Many error-correcting codes give perfect tensors. Indeed, this isn't the one I'm going to use now, though. The one I'm going to use now is actually a 6-qutrate perfect tensor, 6-qubit perfect tensor. So it has 6 legs. It's actually the encoding tensor for the 5-qubit code that Daniel Gottesman talked about maybe last week, I guess it was now. So just trust me, because there's this 5-qubit perfect code, there's this 6-index perfect tensor, which is just the encoding tensor of what the 1-qubit into the 5 for the 5-qubit code. Now, why do I want these perfect tensors? The basic reason why I want these perfect tensors is because, say that now I have some operator, and I've contracted this operator. So this is some other tensor. I've contracted it with the 3 legs, half the legs of the perfect tensor. Then, because this is unitary, it's actually equal. To that for some O prime, where not too hard to figure out what O prime has to be, equals, oh, that's terrible, equals P dagger O Okay? So if you just take this gadget and you stick it in here, you see the PP dagger cancels, and then we're just left with OP. So this means given a perfect tensor, there's a pushing operation. I can take an operator that's contracted with half these three legs, and I can replace it by an operator acting on these three legs. And these two things are equal as tensors. Okay? And that's the key operation that we're going to use. So to actually describe the code, I'm going to show it on my laptop. So do you guys mind now starting the monitor? It's much more fun than trying to draw this by hand. All right. So here's the idea. We're going to take this pentagon tiling of the hyperbolic plane. It's pretty cool, huh? We could just play around with this for the rest of the lecture. All right, yeah, probably I shouldn't do that. Okay. So what we're going to do is, in the center of each one of these pentagons, All right, there we go. So there's a pentagon. So in the center of each one of the pentagons, we're going to stick a tensor. So let's do that. All right. So that's going to be our tensor network. So each red dot is a tensor. And each one is going to be one of these six index tensors. Now, you might complain, well, hey, there are only five legs there. But the idea is that we're going to leave a free leg on each tensor. So five out of the six will be contracted. And then at each point in the bulk, there will be a free leg. So then the free legs will correspond to these J1 through JK. So each red dot corresponds to an input qubit of this map. And then we run everything out to the boundary, and then at some point we cut all the legs at some cutoff that we can think of as being large. And then all the legs that are sticking out at the cutoff we can think of as the output. So that gives a state in the spin chain which is living at the boundary of this. So let me now show a different way of looking at that. So this is how my collaborator draws the picture. Fernando, I think, drew this, right? I don't know if Fernando's here. I think, yeah, you drew this one, right? Yes, his always look better than mine. So this is the same picture, but now you see each red dot here corresponds to one of those input legs, and then the white dots at the edges correspond to the output legs. So there's K red dots, and there's N white dots. And then by hooking these tensors together like this, that defines the code subspace in the Hilbert space of the white dots. All right? Moreover, this tensor, although this you have to think about a little bit, but this big tensor you make this way, it will actually be an isometry. So the different inputs into the red dots will correspond to orthogonal states in the Hilbert space of the white dots. That's why you needed this perfection of the tensors. Right? I mean, just the pushing invertibility would have been good enough, but it's to get this isometry that you need the tensors to be perfect. Okay. But once we have that, well, we're doing pretty good. So, okay, let me see if I can do this. Oh, wow. Okay. So here's a picture you might have seen. Actually, yeah. I feel like I should get royalties for this picture. I drew this picture. So now it's on t-shirts and stuff. So you see here, so the point here is now we can do subregion duality. So bulk local operators correspond, like, say, here's one. It's a little box that acts on this dangling leg sitting here in the center of the red tensor, right? So that's an operator that acts in the logical Hilbert space, say, on one of these logical qubits. But then by doing this tensor pushing operation, I can turn it into an operator on the boundary, right? Because, well, here I can view it as it goes in here, and then it's trivial on these two legs, so I can think of it as acting on those three. And then I can turn it into an operator on these three, right? And then, well, I can do that again. So up here, now this is going in here, and now I can think that the red dot here and the black line here are both identities, so then I can push it onto these three. And I can keep going, and pretty soon I've managed to turn it into a non-local operator acting on the boundary qubits, just by recursively applying this pushing operation. And I can do that with this one over here, too. So this one is closer to the boundary, and you see that closer to the boundary gives you an operator which is smaller on the boundary. And that's certainly, that's consistent, remember, with the ADS-Rindler reconstruction that we saw, right? So this operator here, we needed to have more than half of the boundary to be able to access it. Whereas this one over here, well, we just needed a small part of the boundary to access it. So you see this radial direction that was somewhat mysterious before. Where did the radial direction come from? Well, of course, you know, from the beginning, people always said it had something to do with scale, with the size of things on the boundary. But this is now we've turned that intuition into a precise statement, because we're given a bulk operator. We want to know where it is. And one of the things we can ask is, how much of the boundary do we need to represent it? So this one is near the boundary. We don't need that much of the boundary to represent it. This one is far. We need more. So this is like a quantitative version of the scale radius duality that people talk about. We can also do fun things, like we can send some of the legs this way and some of the legs the other way. And then that's kind of like this entanglement wedge thing I talked about before. So remember, we had this funny situation where we had these two big regions, A and A. And then the causal wedges were like this, but the entanglement wedge was like that. And so we had operators here which, from either of these separately, we couldn't access, but from them together, we could. And here you see an example of that, right? So this one, so just this region here, it wouldn't be enough to access this operator, because you see we only sent two legs there. And just this region by itself, also, it wouldn't be enough to access this operator. But together, they are. And so that's something which is invisible to this methods that she was using about solving bulk equations of motion and so on, right? I mean, what we're using here, which he didn't have available there, is that we're using this entanglement in the code subspace. That's property of the states in the code subspace that enables us to be able to send this both here and there. So that's good. We have this radial commutativity, so that should hopefully be clear, right? I mean, you know, anything here, I can, you know, if something's here, it's going to commute with all the other red dots by construction, and it's going to commute with whatever's over here, because I can just push it that way. We can also have black holes. Remember I said that to get black holes, we go outside of the code subspace. Well, here's the easiest way to do it. So we take this network, and then we had this tensor here, which previously had one qubit input, and we just remove it. So now we got five. I guess the dots change color, because this is from a different paper, but okay. Anyway, the same dots. So now, you see, previously we had one qubit input, now we have five. So these five, I say, correspond to the microstates of this black hole sitting here, which is one ADS radius in size. And now, that's not quite right, of course, because this is a 2 to the 5 dimensional Hilbert space, and there's a 2 dimensional subspace where we just put the tensor back. Okay, so that corresponds to no black hole. But then the complement of that in the 2 to the 5, it corresponds to the microstates of this black hole. And then, if we want, we can make the black hole bigger. I think I forgot to add that. But so we can remove more tensors, right, and push this black region further out. And what happens is that the number of green dots grows with the area as we do that, right? So the entropy of the black hole is growing like the area. And eventually, if we carry this process to its logical conclusion, we've just removed all the tensors. And the green dots are now equal to the white dots in Fernando's picture. And now we've got the whole Hilbert space, right? Because we've removed all of the contractions. So we just have some huge black hole eating the whole Hilbert space, and now we've accounted for all the degrees of freedom in the theory. Was a question?
Yeah, so you kind of, so this code is supposed to encode the low energy subspace onto the boundary.
Yeah, this one, yeah.
Right, this one.
Yeah.
And then the black hole, we kind of can't
Yeah.
It's kind of, you know, how much flow of information into the low energy subspace is going to be given.
Oh, good. So
that's not the same as the black hole microstates, which would be encoded in the full Hilbert space on the boundary.
Sorry, yeah, good. So let's be clear about that. So by doing this, I'm enlarging the code subspace. So the code subspace is up to you. It's not like there's one code subspace and we always have to use that one. There's one which is nice to think about when you're first getting used to these ideas, which is the one where there aren't any black holes. All right, that's the one where you can see all of these things that we derive from low energy effective field theory. But once you've got that under your belt, there's nothing to stop you from expanding your mind and starting to include black holes. And you see here that if I have an operator on this blue dot, I can still represent it here, right? You know, here or over here somewhere, right? So there is still quite a bit of redundancy in the description because, you know, in most of the space, there's no black hole, so we still have effective field theory going on. I mean, it gets harder, right? So I can't run it that way, but that's Beck reaction, right? I mean, that you know, that's saying that indeed, you know, the bigger the code subspace gets, the less information you can sort of robustly protect. But I say that's physical. So I mean, I should emphasize this again, right? So I mean, I claim this kind of picture gives a physical bulk interpretation to every state in the boundary Hilbert space. It's just that most of them have these black holes, and that's the whole point. That's how gravity is able to realize these seemingly contradictory features of low energy effective field theory. Is because you're really not looking at most of the Hilbert space when you're looking at those features.
Yeah, you kind of model black holes as black box that feeds logic into the code.
Yeah.
But yeah. You could interpret that as like just hot radiation down from the black hole.
Well, no, you shouldn't think of it as dynamical. I mean, although this picture looks like the bulk, I'm describing a state in the boundary theory, right? Because I feed the inputs into the green and blue dots, and it prepares a state for me. What?
You don't have a network for the interior. You kind of just ignore it.
Well, good. So there's a question, what's back there, right? Yeah, so that's a question. So and something that I haven't answered here is what's in the interior, and it's not a coincidence that I didn't answer that. And so yeah, let me now talk about that because that's basically where I wanted to stop. Well, actually, let me talk about it in 2 minutes because I wanted to say two other things first. Yeah.
You just mentioned about the codes. There isn't one code subspace.
Yeah.
Can you characterize sort of the set of all of them? Is it supposed to just be semi things that are correspond to semi
No, I mean, I think you're free to include any state you want into the code subspace. And then the question is, I mean, because every state in the CFT has a physical interpretation in the bulk.
Right. I just mean in the setting of ADS CFT, what would be the analog of, what would be?
No, but I'm saying in ADS CFT, every state in the CFT has a bulk interpretation. In ADS CFT. And in ADS CFT, you can include whatever you want in the code subspace. It's just if you do that, the code subspace might not be a very good code. And the reason it might not be is because there might be these huge black holes floating around, which make it hard for you to, for example, push this thing that way. But that's, I mean, that's correct. I mean, that is how the physics works, because there's this big black hole sitting there in the way. And honestly, that's the whole point of these models, is so they're supposed to give you some intuition for the global structure of the Hilbert space in quantum gravity. Not just the states which make us feel good, but all the states. All right, so let me just close with a couple comments. In the introduction, I mentioned the Ryu-Takayanagi formula. I said that was one of the funny features, which I didn't totally understand. So I didn't have time to explain it to you, but in these models, the Ryu-Takayanagi formula is basically true. Now, the basically is slightly embarrassing. Fernando has this beautiful proof where forget about the black holes. Forget about the black holes and just go back to this kind of setup. And moreover, instead of having the dangling red legs, just contract all the legs so we just prepare one state in the boundary. Then Fernando has this very elegant proof that the Ryu-Takayanagi formula holds for any connected region. As soon as you start including the bulk legs, in these models, sometimes it still works and then sometimes it doesn't. And that's related to the fact that often you can do this subregion duality, but then sometimes you kind of get stuck you know, because of these sort of discreteness things in the network. So in the paper, we just kind of said, OK, well, this more or less works, so that's nice. But then There was another paper by Hayden Nizami Chi, Thomas Walter and Yang from Stanford, which showed that if you, instead of these perfect tensors that I had here, you instead put random tensors. And by random, I mean each node gets its own random tensor. So they're chosen independently at each node. And moreover, you allow the range of the links to be large, which is a good thing, right? That's like the large n limit in the CFT. Then they showed that on average, the Rutaki-Nagi formula almost always holds for arbitrary regions, and including the dangling legs. And similarly that, well, for example, by the theorem I proved last week, that the entanglement wedge reconstruction also works almost surely in the ensemble of the random tensors. So that, I think, is a really beautiful result. I'd originally been thinking about trying to present it to you, but it just would have been impossible. But I encourage all of you to go read that paper. I think this is a little bit easier to understand, you know, the first time, just to get the idea. But in terms of getting something that really works all the time, these random tensors are really nice. Okay, so then the last thing, I wanted to just talk about the interior a little bit. So, well, in general, I mean, so these models, so they capture the three things I said, but they don't capture everything. And remember, as we said at the beginning, that's not necessarily, shouldn't be viewed as a failure, but on the other hand, we'd still like to understand more stuff, right? I mean, this tells us some things about holography. So prominent things on the list that it doesn't achieve. So first of all, there's no dynamics. We discussed that, right? I mean, I never wrote down a Hamiltonian. I sort of gave you a caricature of the Hamiltonian because I told you which states I thought were low energy. But okay, how low? Which one's the ground state? That kind of question I don't know how to answer. This is coarse-grained at the ADS scale, right? So you see I don't really have tensors on, the mesh doesn't go on distance scales small compared to the ADS radius. There have been some attempts to fix that, but I think it's going to be hard to really make that work using these crude kind of models because, you know, locality and Lorentz invariance at distances small compared to the ADS radius really use special properties of conformal field theories, right? The coupling has, the lambda has to be large, not just the n. You know, and to get Lorentz invariance, you need the full continuous conformal group, whereas here we just have some sort of discrete caricature of the conformal group. The final thing, which was already complained about astutely by the audience, is that, well, this is kind of cowardly, right? Because I just removed the black hole and I didn't tell you what was going on inside. And isn't that where the money is, right? I mean, isn't that really the problem? You know, at the end of the lecture yesterday, I defined the information problem as describing the interior of the black hole in the same language where the unitarity is manifest. Here I haven't done that. I've used a language where it's clear we're doing ordinary quantum mechanics, there's a Hilbert space and so on, but I just excised the interior. I mean, the problem, though, is that these last two things I said sort of seem to be related, because the question of what happens to you if you fall into a big black hole in ADS is a sub-ADS kind of question. It's this funny thing about ADS. No matter how big the black holes are, you only have an ADS time inside before you die at the singularity. So I don't really know if using these kinds of tensor networks we're going to be able to understand what happens to someone in the interior. I'm confident that we will eventually be able to understand it. You know, I'm optimistic about, you know, many of the things I've heard from all of you at this workshop. You know, I feel like we're still learning a lot about how these things work. You know, I'm having fun. I think it's a very exciting time. And there's a lot for all of us to do. So certainly I'm happy to talk to anyone about any of these things in the future. All right, thanks. Yeah, so, well, that's what I meant by large lambda. Yeah.
So would you expect,
Well, it depends what you mean by Rutakyanagi. So you get something that looks like Rutakyanagi, but of course it's not really Rutakyanagi. I mean, the area operator is not, you know, the area of a submanifold in a you know, Lorentzian manifold, right? I mean, it's you know, like the number of tensors you cut or something, right? So I mean, so that's just too discrete to, for example, tell, like, you know, is it actually the area or is it the integral of the extrinsic curvature, you know, whatever else you have on the surface. I mean, you know, these kinds of things are, I mean, it's just too discrete to answer that. And I think the thing that's interesting, though, or what that buys you, is that you learn that to get it at this crude level, you don't need the large lambda, you know, and you don't need the large gap in the operator spectrum of operator dimensions. There's this skeleton of the correspondence that goes through, even in these stupid discrete models, right? I mean, I had, you know, in the Q-trip model, the Rutakyanagi formula held exactly. You know, I never expected that you could have the Rutakyanagi formula hold exactly in anything or any version of the Rutakyanagi formula, you know. But of course, you know, it's still a cartoon. So, you know, it doesn't actually look like the real Rutakyanagi formula in complete detail. You know, the symbols I write are slightly different. I mean, it's some kind of geometry, but it's not, you know, Lorentzian geometry of manifolds and metric tensors and so on. It's something that's more crude than that. I mean, and this was this discussion we had at the end of the discussion yesterday about, you know, are these metaphors or are these the beginning of a controlled approximation? So, you know, I mean, some people want to say this is the beginning of a controlled approximation, and then, you know, sort of by adding more terms, we'll actually get ADS CFT. I personally am not too optimistic on that. For me, this is more of a metaphor. You know, trying to turn this into a controlled approximation sounds too much like loop quantum gravity, and we know that doesn't work. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Well, I don't know. Yeah. So good. So, I'm allowed to feed in whatever I want to the green dots, so I can get all the microstates, and I can feed in superpositions or mixed states or whatever you want. Yeah. Oh yeah, certainly. So I mean, one simple thing you can do is just put the tensor back. You can also entangle two of them in the way to get the thermofield double. But I still think it's possible that even the generic ones have a little bit of geometry inside. I'm not so postmodern that I've accepted that the generic ones are singular at the horizon. I mean, to me, that's a sub-ADS question which can't be resolved here. I think what this tells you is that the deep inside the interior, the geometry is gone. But I'm not so concerned about that because nobody can see that anyway. You know, I just care about what I see if I jump in. So then I only need a few ADS distances inside for that. I think it's probably not consistent with that, but I don't think we actually expect that, right? I mean, we know that for a while the wormhole can grow, like if you start in a special state, like the thermofield double. But generic states, I mean, who knows? I mean, I tend to think of wormholes pretty operationally. So to me, a wormhole means that, you know, like Juan said, Romeo and Juliet can jump in from the two sides and meet in the middle. If the wormhole is exponentially long, then what does it even mean? You know, if nobody from one side can see something from the other side. So I think it's more natural just to say the bridge is cut off in the middle at some point via some physics, which we don't yet totally understand, although I have some ideas about it. What is the generic what? Oh, good. Yeah, so the question is, what is the generic mechanism of a system for which it would be holographic? Well, for conformal field theories, we think we know the answer to that question. It was referred to by one of the other people already. So we think it needs to have a large central charge or the higher dimensional analog of that, and there needs to be a large gap in the spectrum of low dimension operators. Now, here we're talking about things that aren't conformal field theories, so we can't apply those criteria to it. But there's some vestige of the conformal field theory here. I think the key thing here is the long-range entanglement in these states. So the correlation functions in these states usually are power law. Now, there's some subtlety with that statement directly in the, with the perfect tensors. But in general, in these kinds of things, you expect power law correlations, right? Like in Mera. And if the entanglement falls off faster than that, then there's sort of not enough entanglement to build up this stuff in the center, right? Like, so we already argued over here in the Q-trit model that this state chi needed to have a lot of entanglement in order for the redundancy of the code to work. So in the CFT, that's sort of manifested by the long-range order. And actually, indeed, in quantum field theories that aren't conformal, you know, if they're confining or you turn on a mass or something in the boundary CFT, then what you find when you solve the equations in the bulk is that this center of the geometry gets removed. Because, you know, at the scale set by the mass gap. I think Brian Swingle is one of the first people to emphasize this in his tensor network paper. And specifically in the context of the entanglement. Of course, it was known geometrically already from the beginning. So being gapless, I think, is essential. Lunchtime.
Okay, if not, then thank you. So, I think we all agree we've had an exciting time here for the past 2 weeks. And of course, the success of the school relies on having great students and marvelous lecturers. However, all of those folks, or all of our lecturers, have had their time in the limelight, and we've thanked them all with our generous applause. However, one of the great things about this school, or doing it at Perimeter, is that Perimeter has a really dedicated team of support staff who are running around making sure that things happen. And usually their aspiration is to get everything done, make sure no one complains so that they can go unnoticed. So I thought it would be fun to bring a few of those folks to the stage here today so that you can show them your appreciation firsthand. So I'd like to start with the Bisto staff who have been working overtime to make sure that you've been getting marvelous lunches and snacks at the coffee breaks. And so if you folks could all come out, we have some representatives. Come on out. Audience, man. So we're handing out a memento of our appreciation there. The next team that I really wanted to recognize was the AV staff, who made sure that all of the lectures were recorded, who made sure that things were beamed out to our remote participants, who were eager to make things work, even when I changed my mind 3 times in the course of the morning. And so I also wanted to bring out the AV team, and so we've got a few representatives from our AV team here at Perimeter. So come on out, guys. You can tell that they're not used to the recognition and that they're all trying to hide behind the pillars over there. I guess we're saving the best for the end here. There are two folks who were really at the center of the storm. And so I'm going to start with Emma. Come on out, Emma. Emma's a summer student. She's an old hand at this now. She's been doing this for several years, but She's our prime gong ringer to herd you all back in, but she's been doing all sorts of jobs. And then last but not least, and before you start applauding, I'd like you to remember that if you expect your expenses to be reimbursed, this is the person. But Stephanie was really in it from right from the beginning. When we were applying for this It From Qubit grant, I went to her office and I said, I need a budget. We're gonna have a school and it's gonna be a workshop at the same time. And that got a quizzical look, and I couldn't go much further because I really didn't know what I meant. But Stephanie, now you know what a summer school and a workshop at the same time means. Oh yeah, well that was another one. I kept telling her that we were going for an epic event, and she taught me that epic is a four-letter word. But she's the person that kept my crazy ideas in line and herded along all of the other support staff who made sent innumerable emails, made all sorts of arrangements. And so she's really the nuclear engine that's been driving this workshop. So Stephanie, come on out. And I have to say, these are just a few of the folks. There's a whole team of people around Perimeter who've been working hard to make this happen. There's Ella standing over here with the camera. She was essential in putting together this t-shirt that all of you guys like. There are all sorts of folks who have been making a contribution. And so I just wanted to let them know how much we appreciate all the hard work that you've been doing. Okay, thanks.
So there's one more person on the stage who hasn't been thanked yet, and as you can gather, he has put an enormous amount of work into turning this event into a success right from its inception. We didn't know what it was going to be, and it's really his vision that was realized here over the past couple of weeks, and I've had a fantastic time. I think many of you have had really a great time. I'm going to be recovering from this for the next few months, watching the lectures that I have missed online. It was really one of the best events I've been to in ages and ages, unlike anything I've been to before, and it's thanks to Rob. Let's give him a round of applause.
Okay, but we have one more lecture. Oh, I should actually, before they go, I wanted to thank our friendly assistants for handing out roses. But I also wanted to give a special thanks actually to my assistant, Mayera. Many of the people on the organizing committee may know Mayera. She's the person who kept sending out emails about organizing this doodle poll or that doodle poll. She's also been collecting all sorts of problem sets and solution sets. And so, Mayera, thank you very much for your efforts as well. I didn't want to overlook.